She leave or is she coming right back?
Okay, I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. We are Thursday, March 2nd, 2017, and we're going to get started. We have a couple of people who are coming late today, but I wanted to... So today we have two big topics that we're going to be covering. One is all about Oregon's nascent cider industry, and we're going to be hearing all about that in an informational meeting kind of context, and then we have a bill that is related to the cider industry. We also are going to be hearing Senate Bill 805, which has to do with support for our extensions programs that run out of Oregon State University. And if you're unclear on where I stand on that bill, just look at my tie. And so I'm not saying anything at this point. But
all right. That's good.
We have a couple of legislators who are around, and I want to accommodate their schedule. So I want to first bring up Senator Thompson to speak to Senate Bill 677, which has to do with cider. So I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 677, and I will ask Senator Thompson why he cares about cider.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the rest of the committee. My name is Chuck Thompson, Senate. I represent Senate District 26. I suppose the reason I'm here is I read through this bill and I saw the word pear, P-E-A-R. So I did a little bit of reading and research into this, and the folks that are going to come up behind me are going to tell you about the cider industry. I know from my experience in several of the wineries that we have in the Hood River area, they not only do grape and raise grapes and have some really good wines, but they've also, because of pear and apples, they've developed some really tasty ciders. And these, if you look at a cider, if you look at the ingredients, you'll always find the word apple or you'll find the word pear. They use a lot of the ingredients, even if, you know, lemon, cider, all different kind of flavors, you'll see a lot of the bases end up with the pears and the apple in them. And there's, you know, like my family raises 170 acres of pears. I am not in the pear cider business and will probably never be in that business, but it's a growing thing in the Hood River Valley and all over the state, and these guys are going to tell you about it. So thanks for having me.
Okay, questions? Yes, Senator Roblin.
I have a couple. Is that okay? The first one has to do with what is the state fruit?
Pear.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And I have to ask this question. I have to ask this question only because there was a representative I served with for a long time from the Gresham area who used to always ask, does that include the Asian pear?
I think it would include the Asian pear.
Okay, yeah. As long as those things are both there, it would makes me happy. Thank you.
Okay, I have a couple.
That's the first time I've been able to answer a question on the spot like that.
You're getting better.
I have a couple more for you.
Senator, I've heard you referred to as the pear czar. Would that be a fair characterization?
Well, I think that would. I have been known to tell a few legislators in the past that they need to grow a pear, though.
Senator
Thompson.
He's running out.
Follow your own advice. Okay.
She's not back.
So we can obviously harvest no more from that individual. So I will I'll close for now our public hearing on Senate Bill 677.
Let's go to
is she out there?
No, she's at a committee, I think.
Oh.
No.
Yep.
Do you want to have her to sign out after
this? She's otherwise
she's
occupied, we don't need
she's
her.
She's in a committee, so that's good.
All right, great.
Said she would come right back.
Okay, all right.
All right, well, let's go ahead and go into our cider presentation. So I'm going to open our informational meeting on Oregon's cider industry and ask Dan Lawrence and Nick Gunn to please come up.
Well, that's a very hard act to follow.
Our best. Thank you, Chair and Committee, for letting us speak today. My name is Nick Gunn. I'm the president of the Northwest Cider Association. I am also a cider maker. My wife and I started Wandering Angus Cider Works back in 2003. We're one of the earlier cider producers in the state and actually in the entire country. And I came into cider via the wine industry. My wife's parents started Bethel Heights Vineyard back in the 70s. And it's really become a Salem institution and one of the older wine companies that are out there. We learned winemaking. We learned how to make cider through winemaking. Cider is a wine by legal definition. And as a wine, it requires a fruit that needs to be grown first and then processed. And we learned how to open a tasting room and start a business back in 2003, the only way that was available to us, which at the time is still what's available to cider producers, which is a conditional use permit. The law currently is not allowing for the same abilities that wineries have. And Dan will go more into detail about the bill itself. But I was just giving context on how I got involved with this, and also as an advocate for the entire association now as the president of the NWCA. This is something that is very near and dear to all of our hearts, because in our industry right now, what we lack more than anything is really quality cider fruit. We have a lot of great fermenting minds out there. Our state has really created a great appreciation for cider. Across the country, cider is 1% of beer sales. Here in Oregon, cider is near 5% of beer sales. We have a fervent consumer base, and we have a great level of producers as well. In the NWCA, we have over 80 producers now. And we're ranging far into the millions of gallons. We have a lot of energy, a lot of job creation, a lot of growth happening within the cider industry. So we're trying to advocate for ways to get better raw materials into the hands of these cider makers. And that's oftentimes the hardest part. We can't grow that quality fruit very cost effectively all the time. And really the best way to sell that product then is just to sell it right where you grow it. That requires, obviously, the ability to do that. Right now, what's in use is a lot of us utilize larger orchards that grow a commodity apple or bulk apples that are used for juicing and make use of them and still make pretty good cider, but it's not quite the style of cider a lot of people want to make, nor is it the quality. There are varieties that we use for cider that you would never eat. In fact, you would be crazy to put them in your mouth. In England, they call them spitters, and they are truly horrific tasting apples. But if you blend them right and use a deft hand, like wine grapes aren't eating grapes, you can make world-class ciders, and that's what we're aiming to do. It's just really hard to talk the conventional orchards of a larger scale into transitioning to apples that taste horrible. I couldn't talk any farmer. I've tried, trust me, for a decade now. So we're really out there trying to embrace the growth of the industry and help it along, but we're also, as leaders in consumption, we're also leaders in quality. We have more cider makers winning awards on a worldwide basis here in the Northwest than anywhere else in the world. And we are really recognized as becoming the epicenter for quality hard cider. And it is a real nascent industry. That is a great way to describe it. We're like the wine industry of 30 years ago. But it's also exciting. And we're out to try to get more orchards in the ground and quality apples. Because if we can do anything here well in the Northwest besides making ciders, we can grow the fruit really well. Apples grow great here in Oregon. And we cider as an agricultural commodity should be appreciated and enjoyed as such, and as opposed to trucking it all the way from Central Washington and pressing it down at your facility and selling that to the customer. That is a story to tell, but it's really great story also to tell. This apple was grown right here. You get to taste it right here. You get to learn about the cider making process. So we're out to try to make that better.
Go ahead, Dan.
Sure. I think that Nick touched on some really important things that are happening in the industry.
Dan? Yes. Before you go on, could you give us your name for the record?
Yes, absolutely. Very sorry, Mr. Chair. My name is Dan Lawrence. I am with Stone Circle Cider. We are a fledgling cider business that is in the process of starting our operations just outside of Estacada, Oregon. I think Nick really said quite a bit in outlining the state of the industry. I think the only thing I'd really add to it is the amount that we've seen cider grow in the last really 15 years. I mean, since you began operations in 2003, it's completely different from how it was. And if you look at alcohol sales or dollars per consumer towards cider, even 5 years ago, were around $200 for cider. Have quadrupled in that time. So the expansion of the industry is happening at an enormous rate. It has started to slow down a little bit. We're looking at Oregon producers, craft cider in Oregon, projecting to increase sales by about 16% in 2017. I think that you did a great job of outlining what's happening in the industry. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Were you going to go through this PowerPoint, or was someone?
Oops.
Oh, we didn't actually realize this.
There was a giant screen right there.
We're so focused.
We could go over this real quick, and I don't mind at all. And this is really a lot of what the NWCA puts together, but it's hard to see on this map, but there is our 80 current members amongst the NWCA. We actually have a good participation rate for a regional trade organization, but there are still 120 total cideries in our area, which is pretty astounding considering when I started there was about three. So we've grown a lot. We represent British Columbia, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and Montana right now. When we have 38 members just in Oregon alone. Washington has a little more than us, but we have quite a few. And what's interesting, you can't see really well from here, but on this, I have some pamphlets I can leave on the side table too. Most of those cideries in the Oregon area are not just cider makers, but they're growers too. So of those 38 members, approximately 32 currently grow cider apples themselves and have had to go through either the conditional use permit process, that's what they had to do. And there's a lot more in planning. What's interesting also is that there's a lot of cider orchards that are going to be making cider that they just never thought they were ever. Representative Thompson, right?
Senator Thompson.
Sorry, Senator Thompson.
That's all right. He's out of the room.
He's not here.
he's a rep now. Yeah.
He might be making pear cider at some point in time. So why invest in cider? So cider, between 2011 and 2013, it literally tripled. I mean, we had 100% growth annually between those 3 years. And that was amazing. I mean, it was great for our business. It was great for everybody's business. We're slowing down to a more reasonable 16%, which is actually more in line with what craft brewing is right now. And that's actually a more sustainable number. No industry can expect to grow at 100% every year. And this is just what Dan was getting at, some of the dollar share of how much money people are spending on cider. And this really comes down to the economic factor and why cider is so important for Oregon and for Oregon's businesses. That tripling of business is increasing that. You can see the 300% growth in dollar sales. That is phenomenal. And what's really comical about all of this is really thinking in the context of the larger world of cider. So England and France, they have about an 18% market share for cider. And remember, I was telling you the United States is at 1% right now. Our area for growth is, it's it's really hard to comprehend. Because also England and France have very small relative populations, that's percent of their whole population. If you think of, even if we increase to 3% nationwide here in America, you're going to see a lot of apple growers doing very well and being very happy that cider has grown so much. And at the end of the day, that's kind of what this really is about for the farmers, is that it's going to be bringing a lot more value to a crop that's been devalued due to Chinese imports and a lot of other market impacts. So these are some more stats. We're at 3.5 million gallons annually here in the Northwest. We obviously have a connection between the farmers and the consumers, which is unique. I think a lot of my craft brewing friends wish they could talk more about their ingredients outside of the hops. You know, most of the malted barley comes from the Midwest in one or two states. It's really unique to be able to talk, like wine does, about like your local agricultural product and how you can make it into a value-added product that people, consumers, can enjoy. And then the cider apples. Really, the big deal, like I was mentioning before, is that we just don't have enough of the quality apples that taste bad but make good cider.
And you spoke to that.
And I already spoke to that, but there's a pretty picture. That's one of the nice orchards. And then Oregon is just become the epicenter. If the Northwest is the epicenter across the region, Oregon is, or across the country, Oregon is the epicenter amongst the Northwest. Even though there's a few more producers in Washington, that has more to do with just a few more apple growers. We just have this consumer base here and a fermentation knowledge here that is coinciding to create the best brands that are available right now in the cider industry. And we're really proud of that. And I think that's something Oregon needs to embrace and really take the leadership role on. All right, now it's time for some less exciting stuff.
Okay, so let me, I haven't actually opened the public hearing on SB 677, did I?
You recessed.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, I'll reopen it, and we can talk about the bill. Okay, so I'm going to reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 677. And actually, before you get started, Beth, do you want to give us a summary of the bill?
Mr. Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 677 would establish a cider business as a permitted use on EFU and mixed farm and forest use lands. The measure modeled on the winery statute would also specify the related uses allowed at such businesses and authorize up to 18 agritourism or other commercial events at these locations each calendar year. There is a dash one amendment available on OLIS that replaces the term brew with make in definitions and removes a requirement that an applicant for a permit to establish a cider business submit proof to the local government that applicant meets the production acreage requirements. It also removes a requirement for setback from property lines and authorization from variance for such requirements.
Okay, thank you, Beth. And actually, gentlemen, before you start, Vice Chair Olson, you're the sponsor of this bill. So are there any comments you'd like to make introducing it?
Thank you. I really appreciate that, and I apologize for being late. You know, when we always have so much stuff to do. This actually, bill got started by Dan himself. He actually came to me as his senator from Estacada and with a really great idea, and my chief of staff was very instrumental in having me have Dan into my office and listen to what he was talking. And so the history of this bill is, I told Dan, I said, it sounds good. You're going to base it very close to the wine legislation that we have. But the first thing I told them was, you need to go out and get everybody in your organization to help, because as an individual, it would be very difficult to move the bill just for himself. And so he obviously brought in, he brought in Nick to support this bill, and that's how this process went forward. And I was only the person that allowed them to put it in and get an LC on it. They did all the work and all the effort, and I really give them kudos for the effort you've done, because I think it's a very good piece of legislation.
Great, thank you.
But my name's on it, of course I'd say that. And if it was bad, it must have been Senator Przanski's.
Well, you may not want to laugh, since I was the one that did the wine one, so that's what you based it on.
What a high power committee.
We're in the vices.
Yeah. Okay, Mark, so do you want to talk to us about this bill? Certainly, I think I can go ahead
with that.
Great.
I would like to say, Vice Chair Olson, you do yourself a disservice. Your office has been very instrumental in getting us this far, and we're very pleased to be here, and we're very happy with the bill that we've been written. In a nutshell, what this bill does is it establishes allowed land use for orchards that have a minimum of 15 acres of apples or pears to produce and sell hard cider on their property. So what this is based off of is a statute called ORS 215.452, which established the same precedent for the wine industry. So really what we tried to do was we tried to take that, our concept was to take that statute that's in existence and say, okay, where it says vineyard, I want you to cross it out and say orchard. Where it says grapes, cross it out and say apples and pears. So really to extend a protection and level the playing field between our two industries, which are so closely related, and they're really related in a number of facets in both process and regulation. The process for making hard cider is almost identical to that of making wine. Basically, what you do is you take the fruit, you crush the fruit, you squeeze the juice out of it, and you allow the juice to ferment. And that's it. That's really all there is to it. There, you know, are a couple intricacies to it, but that is the basic nuts and bolts of both wine and cider making. And for that reason, they're regulated very similarly on both the federal level and the state level. Federal level is regulated through the TTB. It is the same exact license. You become a bonded winery through the TTB, so you can pay taxes through that. Same license for wine and cider. And then on the state level, it's regulated through the OLCC. And again, there, it's a winery license through the state. So they are regulated very, very similarly. And I think that the connection between the two industries is there, and it makes sense to have a similar regulation in terms of regarding land use, which I think that there is really no distinction between wine and cider other than the type of fruit that's being grown on the property. The only update that we really made to the bill to alter it from the original wine bill was just to update the threshold requirements. So it's still a minimum of 15 acres, just like the wine bill was. The wine bill had a threshold of if you're making more than 50,000 gallons, you need to have a minimum of 40 acres. We kept the 15 and 40 acres the same. We did change the threshold of 50,000 gallons to be more consistent with juice yields per acre for apples versus juice yields per acre for grapes. And then you want to click over a couple slides.
Oops. Sorry. I'm doing a bad job in slide moderator.
No worries. So really the purpose of this bill is to ensure farmers that grow cider fruit have a path to process and sell the fruit grown on their property. I guess I can indulge in a little bit of personal experience. I'm actually from Iowa originally. And if you look at what's happened in Iowa over the last really 50 or 60 years, you've seen small farms become less and less tenable. And it's gotten to the point where we're at now where if you don't have a 1,000-acre farm, you're not making money farming in Iowa. So what, and I think that speaks to legislation like this that I think can help enable and encourage farmers to add value to the products that they're growing on their own property and really do a little bit more with less. Because when you have fewer farmers and bigger farms, you have fewer people shopping in the communities, and then the general stores go down, Main Street stores suffer, and kind of the dominoes fall from there. And in Iowa, that has really decimated these small rural communities that were once thriving with more farmers and more small farms. So I think if you can have a bill like this that allows you know, farmers to add value to their product and potentially potentially add a few jobs out in the country while they're at it and bring in tourism dollars from the cities. It's really, you're doing right by your rural communities by passing this type of legislation. The purpose is also to extend to the cider industry the same opportunities provided to the wine industry. I spoke to that, and that's really just leveling the playing field with two very similar products. And then also preventing local government from creating roadblocks for farmers and small businesses. So this, you know, really depends on which county you're in and which local authority you're dealing with. To go through a conditional land use process, I know in Clackamas County, it costs $4,000 just to go through the process, and there's a lot of ancillary costs associated with that as well. $4,000 and a 5 to 6 month, and going through a 5 to 6 month intensive process. It's very involved. So this, you know, and that's Clackamas County. In other counties, it's even harder, if not impossible in some circumstances. Other counties, it is easier as well, but it takes that. It takes that roadblock out of the picture and allows, you know, fledgling businesses to get their start a little less impeded. So impact, again, it reduces significant barriers to entry for fruit farmers who wish to add value to their crop by processing it into cider. It incentivizes more farmers to plant cider fruit, which Nick spoke to is a really important part of being able to drive growth and drive an innovative quality product. It can be challenging to convince farmers to plant cider fruit because it really only has one function, and that's to be squeezed into juice. It can't be sold fresh. It's not something that it's oftentimes something not something that you're going to want to eat. It's these varietals are bred for cider, and they're in very high demand and short supply. So it's something critical to the industry. And this bill in particular is really promoting farm cideries, and farm cideries are going to produce those types of apples that the industry really needs to help continue to grow. And just in general, this is a helpful bill for the industry. It helps an industry that's fostering an industry that's growing really, really quickly, and it enables more people to get into the game, which will drive growth and drive innovation within the industry. Also very importantly, it establishes a new agritourism business, so cider makers can invite people to come to the farm and see how they're producing, what they're producing, try the product, enjoy the orchards, much the same way that the wine industry has established a tourism industry around their farm operations. And it really helps bring a historically cider was always made on the farm, and it helps bring it back to the farm.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Dan. Any questions for these gentlemen about the bill?
Statement.
Yes, Senator Prezant.
So it's interesting. Justin King, who's with King Estates, I had an opportunity to meet with him last week, and he introduced me to some vintage cider that they're just starting to do from their apples on their property. And he's saying basically what I'm hearing here is that, you know, we have another potential growth industry within a commodity that hasn't been, let's say, fully realized. And it was very nice to have that perspective and seeing how they have diversified their estate into multiple different things and how they're actually going to bring it forward. And I think he said that this first pressing was like 1,000 cases, but it sounds like that they're going to continue to move forward. And so it looks like it's, as you're saying, across the state, we're seeing this opportunity, and it's a great endeavor. So, Dan, thank you for your endeavors of bringing this forward and bringing it there. And, Nick, thank you for being part of that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So let me say something. We do have someone else who signed up to speak in support of the bill. Nobody has signed up against it, but we did get a letter from the Farm Bureau with a couple of concerns. I don't know if you've seen that letter, but it's up on our legislative information system. And, you know, not surprisingly, they have some concerns about the land use implications of this, and I think similar objections that they had with the wine.
No, they never had a problem.
We've done this before.
Yeah. So, and one of the concerns that they had was that this there's not a clear requirement that the business be actually growing the fruit. And that this could just be the winemaker and not the farm where the fruit is growing. And I'm not quite sure I understand their concern there. They haven't come to speak to it, but I don't know if that's something if you've heard that concern before.
Thank you, Chair Dembro. No, I had just heard today that they had concerns, so I have not gotten a chance to read them, and this is actually the first I've heard of them. I'm happy to address that. I believe that the bill is written very clearly that you need to have 15 acres of orchards to qualify for this bill, and I think there's a reason why it is at 15 acres, and that's because, you know, that's around the threshold where, you know, you're out of hobby farm territory. You're clear of hobby farm territory. If you're planting 15 acres of orchards, you're in it. I can tell you just from starting the operations that there's a lot of work involved in that, and it's very much, you know, when you're planting that much, you're farm first, and that's who I think that this bill is intended to protect. I think there's also a safeguard added to that, and that is the volume threshold. So I can understand how they might, or there would be concern, or if there weren't volume thresholds, I could understand how there would be concern. It's like where someone would plant 15 acres and then do a, you know, 800,000 gallon, a huge facility. And that's why there's that volume threshold, where if you're going to have a large facility, you have to have at least 40 acres. So that's why that is there. So in my opinion, I think the bill addresses that concern very clearly to my satisfaction, but I haven't read their letter.
She's here. Okay, any other questions of these gentlemen? Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so I'm going to bring up Mark Nystrom, please. And is there anyone else who would like to speak to Senate Bill 677, the cider bill? The bill having to do with cider.
I'm not wearing orange today, so sorry. Hi, I'm Mark Nystrom with the Association of Oregon Counties, Senator Dembro, members of the committee. We're here in support of this bill. I just wanted to offer the gentleman our assistance in making sure that we get the land use portion of this correct. We did go through this whole process with the winery bill. One of the suggestions that one of the planners had thrown out to me is that perhaps we should include hops in this and continue a discussion of the idea of breweries on similar lands. So we'd be happy to work with whomever we need to, but we'd like to see this keep moving forward, and we're excited about the bill.
Okay, great. Thanks, Mark. Senator Romo?
Yeah, I did not need to notice. You don't have orange, but you do have green on, and it's kind of like...
I need to read the agendas more carefully.
Mark,
I'm sure that was because of
I
apples.
I have a tie in my office.
Yeah. Hey, that, you know, Senator Prusansky, that might clash a little bit. Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, great. Thank you, Mark.
Yeah.
Okay, so we will talk about the setting up a work session for this bill. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 677. Vice Chair, thank you for having brought this, and gentlemen, thank you for your testimony. It was very impactful. Okay, so now I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 805. Beth, tell us what that is, please.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 805 appropriates $9.4 million out of the general fund to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission for the biennium beginning July 1st, 2017, to be expended for the Agriculture Experiment Station and Branch Stations, the OSU Extension Service, and OSU Forest Research Laboratory programs. It declares an emergency, is effective July 1st, 2017, and it does have a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, great. I'm going to ask Commissioner Gabhart to come up, and Senator Robles.
I was just going to talk from here.
Yeah, that's great. Mark, why don't you come on up? And Senator Roblin, as the sponsor of the bill, please talk to us.
Yeah, this was a hard bill for me to do this year because I thought I'd taken care of it last year. I had worked so hard for the last number of years to get into the budget the appropriate amount of money for these statewides. And last year we had a bill for $14 million. It made it through, and it got put through in such a way that it became part of the regular budget. It's not something we had to fight about every year. And so I looked forward to this year of not having to come up with a bill, and then the governor cut about $9 million out of it, and I realized that that would, in fact, and I talked to OSU, and I realized that that would cut out about 70% of the new work that was being done, and that didn't make any sense to me. It was, I just felt sad that we had to go through this again, because I have a lot of people who have worked really hard to get to the place we are, but we finally had done that last year, and the good work that was being done around the state by all of these groups and the new people who were hired had brought another level of enthusiasm to these programs that, and the new people who were hired, it was just an impressive thing to watch the last couple of years. So the money wasn't there. We decided we would do a bill, and I'm excited that the people are here again to talk about it. It's probably a positive thing to get these people out so people can hear about what we've been doing and where we're going, but excited about the opportunity. Thank you for hearing the bill, and I look forward to my other colleagues being helpful as well. Thank you.
Okay, great. Yeah, either of you.
Go first.
Okay, Commissioner, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Denbrough. For the record, I'm Mark Labhart. Senator Johnson asked me to go first so she can catch her breath. I have the privilege of serving on the steering committee for OSU Extension statewide, and have served on that for a number of years as a volunteer. So I take great privilege in coming today to represent Oregon State University and hopefully getting a positive response from this committee on where we're going to go with that. And as the good senator just said, you know, in the 2015 session, the legislature did approve the $14 million, reversing what we called a 15-year trend of decline in vital program services statewide, not just in rural Oregon, but also in urban Oregon. They were forced to eliminate positions. They were forced to eliminate programs, and it had a fairly negative effect on Oregonians in all 36 counties. It was the Extension Service Program, the Forest Research Lab, and the Ag Experiment Station. Senate Bill 805 would enable the statewides to maintain the same level of service, as the good senator said, by providing $9.4 million to increase an increase in general fund services. We again urge your support for this. I want to just very quickly, you do have a copy of this letter before you, but there are folks in the room. I would ask them to please stand. They're from all corners of Oregon that came today in support of this bill. So if we could ask those folks in the room that are here to in support of Senate Bill 805, if you could please just stand up. So, and they're from all corners of Oregon. You have 4-H members as well as long-term volunteers. So in addition to the individuals that are here in support of this bill, the following have also indicated strong support for this bill: Oregonians for Food and Shelter, the Oregon Food Bank, Oregon Forest Industries Council, Oregon 4-H Foundation, Oregon Association of Nurseries, Associated Oregon Loggers, Oregon Cattlemen's Association, Southwest Oregon Community College, Northwest Farm Credit Services, Columbia Gorge Fruit Growers, Oregon Wheat Growers, King Estate, Oregon Water Resources Congress, Friends of Family Farmers. And I'm going through this list. I'd like you to know that it's bipartisan. It's across all groups. It's environmental groups as well as industry groups. Oregon Dairy Farmers Association, Oregon Wine Growers Association, Oregon Small Woodlands Association, Northwest Food Processors Association, Oregon Public Health Association, Oregon Business Association of Oregon Industries, Oregon Farm Bureau, Oregon Environmental Council, Weyerhaeuser Company, Columbia Gorge Community College, Silvies Valley Ranch, National 4-H, and Oregon Women for Agriculture. And those are just the folks that have stepped forward to do that. I think if you talk to a lot of Oregonians, they would tell you that OSU Extension and the other two programs are valued services that are provided to Oregonians. We'd like you to ask that you hopefully consider Senate Bill 805 and restore those cuts that were made, the $9.4 million, to these three programs. Thank you for your time. Be glad to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nice tie.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I have the privilege of representing Senate District 16, and for the longest time, Commissioner, now former Commissioner Labhart, was a partner and a friend, and we miss him a lot in Tillamook County. Permission to use a visual aid?
Sure.
I just want people to remember how important egg exports are to our state.
For the record, that is a block of Tillamook cheese.
Yes, that.
Is there any other?
No. It's a block of extra sharp, something aged, 2 years aged.
This is the good stuff. This is Tillamook white right here. But just to remind everybody how important egg exports are, I was up in my office earlier today, and I'm not going to repeat everything that Commissioner Labhart had to say, but I was up in my office today being talked to by seed growers in Madras, carrot seed growers, and how important it is for them to have the ability and the access to the scientists and the technical folks to help them produce seed that's wanted all over the world. Had the opportunity to talk to folks from my own district who are teachers, who are available for pest management, who are available to consult with people in the egg business and the forestry business. And then probably the rock star, and I was looking around to see if she was in the room, the rock star of my visit today was a young lady who's a senior. She is applying at UC Davis and OSU with an idea towards going into large animal veterinary studies. We spend so much time cleaning up after kids that make bad decisions, and part of this whole extension story is making investments in kids who are going to be our future leaders, our future vets, our future elected folks, and how valuable it is to be there to support those kids. And so I came today to not repeat the things that have been said and are going to be said, but to simply lend my support and to say, coming from an agricultural district, as Senator Roblin, Senator Posianski does, how important it is to make sure that our ag and forestry sectors and our kids are supported, and this is one of the vehicles to do that. Thank you very much.
Good. Thank you, Senator. Any questions for the commissioner or the senator?
It's just a comment. It's really nice that you came here and found the right committee, because this was a heck bill. I thought it was going to come to my education committee. So, but it's really nice that it's here, because we've got FFA over there, and they've got 200 people coming this afternoon.
And in the interest of full disclosure, this is an FFA sheet. Those happen to be great kids, too.
Yes, they do.
Great. Thank you both for coming. Okay, so next up we have Jeff Edgerton, Hella Rudenclaw, and Angela Crowley Cook. Okay, Jeff, you want to start? What do you care about the extension?
Sure. Service? Well, thank you very much for having me here, Senator, and the committee. I appreciate being able to be here and speak about things. My name is Jeff Edgerton. I'm the brewmaster at Bridgeport Brewing Company in Portland, Oregon. We are the original craft brewery in the state of Oregon. We took advantage of the craft brew laws that as it came into being in 1984, and we're the first ones to actually to incorporate as a brewery. So we've been around the block a little bit. We've done this a long time. We have developed a relationship with Oregon State University in the form of the Fermentation Science Program, and we're very, very well connected with that. Tom Shellhammer and Jeff Clausen have set up an incredible program there. It's grown by leaps and bounds. I'm sure you guys all are aware of that. I wanted to throw out a few facts. I pulled up. It's very easy to find these facts, I think, on the if you go to the Oregon Brewers Guild website. But just a couple things about the brewing industry in Oregon. There's 230 operating breweries in the state of Oregon now. There's 261 brewing facilities in 73 cities. It's grown immensely. 70 of those alone are in the city of Portland alone. So it's a huge amount of breweries. 34,564,000 dollars was the value of the hop crop last year that was grown in Oregon. Oregon grows unbelievably good hops. Some of the best aroma hops in the world. Definitely worldwide known. Produced 1,700,000 barrels of beer in 2015. So what this translates to is about a $4.5 billion contribution with brewing and the allied industries in the state of Oregon. Hops and malt, of course, are the backbone of beer. The hops and malt research that's being done at Oregon State University is world class. Obviously, it's what they do there is unbelievable. The competition that is huge right now in the brewing industry. Means that we are always looking for, as brewers, we're looking for the next big innovation. We're looking for the next thing that's going to be interesting and people are going to love to drink. So that has a lot to do with the fact that they hop flavors are developed that are amazing. There's some amazing flavors. I've gotten mint out of hops. I've gotten chocolate flavors out of hops. We tasted a hop one time that everybody described as having a peanut butter character to it. Really interesting, the things that can be developed. In addition to building in things like disease resistance that makes farmers want to grow hops. If you're a hop farmer, you're a very dedicated individual, and if you're familiar with how hops are grown, it's like I grew up in Canby, so just south of me I grew up, and it's like I kind of took hop fields for granted, but the yards alone that they have to put these hops on cost about $12,000 an acre to put up. So when you decide to grow hops, you're going to be growing hops for a while. You have your own hop dryer. You have your own hop processing facility. So these people are very dedicated human beings, and they're very interested in it. They're very interested in the science of hops, and that's where Oregon State University comes in, the programs, all the extension programs. Pat Hayes runs a world-class. He's well-known for running a world-class barley lab at Oregon State University. It's very difficult to convince farmers to grow malting barley these days, or to try to grow malting barley, because malting barley can certainly is sold at a premium compared to feed barley. Something goes wrong with your crop, you have feed barley. It's a problem, and it certainly is. And so trying to get them to grow malting quality barley is very difficult to do. So. We have taken advantage of the students at Oregon State University to help us with development of our we have there's a pilot plant down there that's a 1.7 barrel pilot plant. We've used that pilot plant many times for development of almost all of our beers right now that we have our current lineup of beers. The students down there help us with that. They help us brew. They help us take samples on a regular basis for analysis. They help us to filter the beer and get it ready to come back up again. So it's a little bit of a trek from Portland to go down and do this thing. But the fact that the students are there and they're helping out, it makes all the difference in the world to whether or not that works for us or not. So it's been an incredible program. So much so that my company has made a large donation to the program and to help develop that pilot plant. We want to see that grow. So it's really important to us for that to happen. We have hired students out of that program. We hire them as interns in the summertime to give them some practical knowledge. And at the same time, we have turned a lot of these interns into full-scale brewers and brought them on board. If I want to add one more name to an organization, I feel like I can do this. I was in the leadership for many years of the Master Brewers Association of the Americas Northwest Section. It's a huge section. It's the largest section in the Master Brewers. There's over 400 members. We have meetings where 375 people show up. We're having a hard time finding a venue to to hold all these people now. They're getting huge. people interact, the students interact. We'll get 30, 40 students that will come to these meetings. We welcome them. They come in, they interact with the BRRRRs. So it's all part of that program being being well-funded and everybody having having the right tools to do what they need to do.
Okay, thank you very much, Jeff.
You're welcome.
Before we go on, I just have a technical question.
Sure.
So what's the benefit of getting a flavor into the hop as opposed to into the mash? You know, that is, why not just throw peanut butter in or chocolate in the mash?
Well, it's just, you know, it's maybe it's not peanut butter necessarily, but it's something peanut butter-like or something that's a little bit different. I mean, I think there's some interesting just flavors that maybe haven't even been discovered yet, or you know, I guess maybe that's my point more than anything, is things that haven't even come out. He says, wow, what is that flavor? That's a really interesting flavor. It's sort of like floral, sort of like citrus, something in between, something like that, but it's not necessarily, you know, I mean, it's pretty easy to build a beverage if you want to with using a flavor house ingredients, but we love using those natural ingredients if we possibly can. So,
okay, I know I shouldn't have asked that question. Senator, well,
I'm just going to say that because on the floor the other day we heard from a senator from Corvallis area that there is a goat yoga taking place in that area and that there is now a new goat yoga IPA out of Yahats, Oregon, the little brewery there. So. A lot of different flavors. She did admit that there was no goat bars in the beer. I thought, it's really interesting as these places develop, and the Yahats one is a fairly new brewery,
right.
But it's the fermentation science that you talked about.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because they've got pickles, sauerkraut, kombucha. I mean, it just seems to be taking off in a lot of ways.
Right. If we talk about the bill in the broader sense as well, too, I mean, supporting the extension services that develop berries and fruits and all that kind of stuff. When we design a beer, we design a product, we take great pride in using Oregon products and Oregon ingredients in this thing. So having hops that are grown in Oregon is fantastic. Having a malting barley, I mean, not a lot of malting barley grown in Oregon, but there's a certain amount of it. Having all those things available to us, some of the best water on the planet right here. All the things that we have our glass made by Owens, Illinois, out by the airport. So everything's as local as we possibly can have it be. we make a lot of beers with fruits in them now, using berries a lot. So the extension services are a huge part of that. So.
Senator Brzezinski.
I was going to say, like Citra hops, from my understanding, a lot of people would prefer to doing that than adding it in through a different process. And extracts, one of the beers I brew, I use actually the orange peel. That will add into it. We'll get you that.
Certainly.
But others, you know, like if you wanted to have a additive flavor that's an extract, some people say, well, that's not really pure, and so they want something else that maybe gets them that without that. So, but it's a great way to see how an industry can continue to evolve and actually have things that we never considered, and that's really one of the best things that has happened since we're coming out of that prohibition of getting back to the artisan part of the craft.
Absolutely.
Great. Okay, Ms. Rudenclaw, thanks for keeping me late. Sorry for keeping you late.
No problem. My name is Hele Rudenclaw, Chair Dimbrough, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify. I am a farmer from Amity, and I'm here today to urge you to support Senate Bill 805. This bill asks for $9.4 million for what is known as the OSU statewide, as you're aware, the Extension Service, the Agricultural Experiment Station, and the Forest Research Lab. The statewides have a long history of doing outstanding work in Oregon, and the legislature recognized that 2 years ago with $14 million. This funding allowed the statewides to invest in programs important to Oregonians. I sat before a panel 2 years ago describing the devastation that slugs were wreaking on our fields. We use a farming method called no-till, and there's a picture distributed, on our farm, which means we don't plow between different crops. This no-till reduces soil erosion, increases organic matter, and improves water-holding capacity. It is a good thing for the soil. However, the limiting factor to our success with no-till is slugs. These critters love it when we no-till. We create the perfect habitat for them, and they're very hard to control. The legislative funding increase enabled OSU to hire a slug expert, and Dr. Rory McDonald is currently getting familiar with the various slugs in Oregon and also testing out some food extracts which may be extra delicious to the slugs and hopefully over time develop a way to lure the slugs to the bait so that we can control them better. This is just one example of a sustainable solution to a significant problem resulting from the statewide's work over the last biennium. I personally believe investing in the statewides delivers the best return to Oregon's environment. OSU provides science-based information on how much fertilizer to apply, when to apply it, and in which forms. This ensures we don't apply too much or at the wrong time. And as a result, we protect Oregon's waterways from contamination. If we don't have good research from OSU, we are forced to rely on the chemical and fertilizer dealers who want to sell us product in order that would advise us on how much to apply. In general, the research coming out of OSU shows us how to be sustainable and profitable at the same time. I urge you to recover the investment you made in the last biennium and fund the statewide at their continuing service level with an additional $9.4 million. Without this funding, staff will be cut in non-strategic ways and research programs will be curtailed. As a farmer, I need the access to the science-based, non-biased information which the statewides provide. Please protect Oregon's environmental future by investing in the statewides. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Rudenclaw. Angela.
Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, my name is Angela Crowley Cook. I'm the legislative director at Oregon Environmental Council, and I really appreciated hearing the testimony about the slug research because at OEC we support no-till farming because it's a way to sequester carbon, and so that's another benefit. Glad to hear about the slug research. So we strongly support Senate Bill 805, and are disappointed that we're having to have this conversation again. We supported the efforts last session as well. And that's because we recognize the contribution of the statewides to all Oregonians, students, farmers, ranchers, elected officials, children, youth, and, of course, the environment. The research and outreach efforts of the statewides are essential for achieving reductions in the use of toxic chemicals, improvements in water quality and water efficiency, providing community health services, and climate change adaptation and resilience. One example is that we at OEC are working with a Clackamas Pesticide Stewardship Partnership. And in that work, we've seen how effective extension staff can be in coordinating the dissemination of information to producers. So the program is a voluntary program to reduce pesticide runoff. And so the staff has been delivering integrated pest management workshops in collaboration with OSU's Integrated Plant Protection Center. And that information is going to nursery operators, Christmas tree growers, and it's been very successful. Monitoring after the Pesticide Stewardship Partnership programs showed measurable reductions of pesticides in streams where the growers have participated. So that's just one concrete example of the benefit that the statewides provide, and we hope to see their work increase and the funding increase especially. Thank you.
Colleagues, any questions for this panel? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming and support. Okay, we have four people left, so I'll break them up into two panels of two. Ivan Molesky and Elizabeth Gangwer, please.
Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, for the record, Ivan Molesky with Friends of Family Farmers. Thank you for your consideration of Senate Bill 805 today. We support this legislation. Our organization represents small and mid-sized farmers and ranchers across Oregon, and we are part of the diverse coalition that supported legislation in 2015 to increase funding for OSU Extension and agricultural experiment stations. These programs provide technical support and educational opportunities and research important to farmers and ranchers of all types throughout the state. Through the 2015 funding levels approved by the legislature, OSU was able to deepen investments in programs that support small farms, beginning farmers, community food systems, pollinator health, fermentation sciences, water quality protection, food safety, and much more. Providing funding needed to maintain current service levels via this bill will protect the $14 million investments made in 2015. Our members across the state utilize and benefit from the highly professional technical support, educational programming, and research provided by Oregon's agricultural experiment stations and the extension services. State investment in these programs also helps leverage federal dollars, and the elimination of research positions at research positions, if we don't fund this bill, will ultimately inhibit OSU's ability to compete for federal grant funding. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify today, and we urge your support for Senate Bill 805. Thank you.
Thank you. Hey, Elizabeth?
Hello, Mr. Chairman and Committee. My name is Elizabeth Gangwer, and I'm a Lane County Ambassador for the 4-H program. I'm also the president of the Lane Leadership Team in Lane County. I've been in 4-H. This is my 9th year. I'm a senior in high school, and I show pygmy goats and swine, and I also do projects in photography, horticulture, and welding. 4-H has become a lifestyle to me. I've been in it my whole life and around it with my siblings, too. It has taught me skills that school can't teach you. It has taught me about responsibility and commitment, and has also helped me work harder in school and keep good grades. It has helped me work well with others and to resolve conflicts with others and in situations that are hard and they may have differences than you. Through 4-H, I have become a leader to others, and I've gained self-confidence, and I've been pushed to go outside my comfort zone. Because of 4-H, I want to make a difference in my community, and I like to help others, and I want to keep making a difference in my community after I'm done with 4-H. 4-H has encouraged me to live a healthy lifestyle, and I want to share that experience with others. After I'm done with 4-H this year, I hope to go to OSU next year and study family sciences and human development and double major in education. And after that, I hope to be a 4-H agent in one of the counties in Oregon. I wouldn't be who I am today without 4-H, and it has made me a strong leader to others in the 4-H program. And I hope I can share those experiences with others after I'm done with 4-H. Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Colleagues, any questions for the panel? Okay, thank you both very much for coming and sharing your testimony. So our last panel is Jim James and Joel Fisher. Oh, I missed Fergus McLean. Fergus, you want to come up? Sorry. Where's Joel?
Don't say it.
Fergus, you want to start? You had signed up first. Sorry I missed you.
Senator Denbrough, members of the committee. My name is Fergus McLean. I'm a retired forester from Eastern Lane County. I have my Bachelor of Science degree in Environmental Health from OSU 1974. I'd like to take this opportunity to discuss forest science research in Oregon. I'm speaking in favor of Senate Bill 805 and the interesting projects it funds, like the 2015 grant designed to quantify trade-offs and synergies between ecosystem services in intensively managed forests, led by Matthew Betts of the OSU School of Forestry. Ecosystem services in the forest generally refers to carbon sequestration, a hot topic for you policymakers, and especially important in Oregon, the Saudi Arabia of forest carbon. The science of forest carbon is struggling to keep up. Oregon's entire carbon footprint is smaller than the amount of carbon sequestered by our forests. Yet even the head of our Global Warming Commission is unclear on its staggering scale. Forest carbon science is barely even into its infancy. This morning I'll touch briefly on the history of forest science and management and how this committee and the legislature might move them forward. Post-war schools of forestry taught that old-growth forests were biological deserts and should be cut as soon as possible. Following the publication of Silent Spring, the Environmental Policy Act was passed in 1969, requiring public input and scientific justification of legislation affecting the environment on federal lands. Oregon passed our Oregon Forest Management Act in 1971, which was more advisory than regulatory. The U.S. Department of Defense stopped spraying Agent Orange in Vietnam in 1971, and the very next year, BLM and the Forest Service began spraying it on our national forests with private industry close behind. But with the passage of the Clean Water Act in 1972 and the Endangered Species Act in 1973, spraying on federal forest lands soon came to an end. In Oregon, spraying continues to this day, despite the lack of any comprehensive analysis of its environmental and health effects, since Oregon, unlike Washington, has no state-level Environmental Protection Act, which requires public input and scientific assessment of agency policies. Indeed, state agencies have fought scientific oversight of forest policy, and the legislature has prohibited counties from filling the scientific gap. Dr. Betts' ongoing Forest Research Lab Ecosystem Services study appears to draw on the groundbreaking work of Dr. Andrew Carey of the U.S. Forest Service Olympia Forest Research Station. After 20 years of analyzing and measuring the ecological impacts of different harvest methods, Dr. Carey came up with a method he calls active intensive management, which he claims retains 95% of net ecosystem productivity while producing two-thirds to three-quarters of the timber yield of commercial forestry. Dr. Carey recommends we adopt his system of alternating 70 and 130-year rotations across our entire forest landscape, both on public and private land, to produce a substantial, sustainable quantity of timber with no degradation of forest ecological systems. He has shown us how to do this. Following the listing of the northern spotted owl in 1990 and the adoption of the Northwest Forest Plan, timber production on public lands in Oregon collapsed and private lands ramped up, with few constraints in Oregon on clear cuts or herbicide use. Over the last decade, 85% of private Oregon forest lands changed hands, with the majority now controlled by timber investment management organizations. In other words, Oregon's private forests are mainly operated not by families or even forest corporations, but by hedge funds. And these private speculators in Oregon's forests have enjoyed nearly $1 billion in tax breaks since the severance tax was eliminated in 2002. With the adoption of the Northwest Forest Plan, federal lands policy has been based on ecosystem management. When science is applied to forest policy, it becomes clear that forests must be managed as entire ecosystems. 20 years later, Oregon has yet to take this elementary step to an ecosystems level approach. Today, the Land Board is ready to sell off the Elliott State Forest without considering the potential value of carbon credits, which could be up to $1 billion under projected values. And policy leaders are unclear on the most elementary facts about the value of carbon. Basically, ODF walked away from negotiations with U.S. Fish and Wildlife despite being offered a cut of 25 million board feet, well within historic harvest levels.
Fergus, if you could kind of wrap up and try to keep
it... I got one more paragraph.
Keep it germane to the topic here as
you
much
know,
as possible.
Senator, there are very few places you can have this discussion in Oregon within the framework of Oregon government.
Go ahead.
In his... Basically, ODF dug in their heels based on their insistence on the right of the state to clear-cut the headwaters of the streams in the Elliott, which have listed coho salmon in them, which U.S. Fish and Wildlife couldn't agree with. In his ecosystem study, Dr. Betts is looking only at the consequences of different herbicide treatments on clear-cuts. That's pretty much the range of forest research in Oregon at this point, and it's unfortunate. The Elliott is a place... Dr. Betts has a very difficult time finding places to carry out this kind of research. His research is being done on private land. The Elliott is the perfect place for this kind of research to be carried out. And the state is actually in the best position of any landowner to resolve the present stalemate between ecosystems values on public land and the lack of them on private land. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. James?
Senator Dembrough, members of the committee, my name is Jim James. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. And before I start, Senator Roblin, my green shirt is because trees are green.
That's right.
I'm a proud beaver. Thank you. the OSU Extension Program, the research lab at Oregon State University, is critically important to family woodland owners in this state. There's over 140,000 family woodland owners that own over 4 million acres. 42% of the private forest land in the state is owned by this group of citizens. There are a few retired foresters in that group, but most of those folks rely on the OSU Extension Program, the OSU Research Lab, for the information they need to be good stewards of their land. One common theme that is in family woodland owners is they want to do the right thing, they want to treat their properties right, but often they don't have the wherewithal to know what that is. The OSU Extension Program and the information the research lab provides gives them those tools to be good stewards of their land. I won't repeat a lot of the rationale of why that $9.4 million is needed, because the previous panel did a really good job of explaining that. But family woodland owners fall into that same group. I seriously promote that the $9.4 million be added back to the system. And again, without that type of information, it's certainly possible that landowners won't know the proper science behind why they do what they do on their forest land. I do believe that the forests in Oregon are very well managed, the private forests, but that's because the policies, they're driven by science. We need that science to continue so that we'll always know the right approach to how we manage our forests.
Thank you very much, Jim.
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Fisher, here on behalf of Oregon Business Association and Associated Oregon Industries, two separate associations. We have merged our agendas and are operating under one policy agenda this session. I'll start by saying my fourth grade teacher had a very strict rule, which was don't tell me something that I already know. And I've spoken, I think, with all of you about this issue, so I'm probably going to tell you something you already know, but I need to do it for the record. The experiment stations, the extension services, and the Forest Research Laboratory add an immense amount of value to the Oregon economy. I had the privilege of traveling all around the state during the summer of 2014 with Business Oregon, AOI, and Oregon Business Council. And everywhere we went, we asked local business people, what can we do to help grow the economy? And repeatedly what came back was the extension services, the experiment stations, and the Forest Research Laboratory. Also, not to leave Portland out, there is a lot of interest around the Food Innovation Center in Portland. We cobbled together a group that's been working for the last 3 years called the Oregon Food and Beverage Leadership Council that partnered with Business Oregon to produce a very expansive kind of 10-year key industry roadmap for the food and beverage industry, and one of their top priorities is making sure that we're fully funding, utilizing, and hopefully eventually expanding funding at the Food Innovation Center, which has an impact, although it's located in Portland, absolutely has a statewide impact. So we support Senate Bill 805. Thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you. Senator Roepling.
I was just shocked you left out the master gardeners. I will tell you, the last time in 15 when we were fighting for this bill, they came out in force, and I appreciate them a lot.
They come to my constituent coffees. And,
I was going to tell, that's one of the groups that gets to all my urban friends.
Great. Any questions for this panel? Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen. Is there anybody else who wants to speak to Senate Bill 805? Okay, seeing not, I will close our public hearing on Senate Bill 805, and we'll, I assume, have a work session on this next week.
Great.
It would be my preference to send this directly to the floor, but unfortunately, it needs to take a little trip into Ways and Means land, but we will certainly move it in that direction. Senator Roblin.
And I appreciate the fact that Senator Johnson and I will both be there to guide it as much as we can. So.
That's great. Okay, colleagues, I think that does it for us for this week. So with that, until next Monday, we are adjourned.
Thank you.
By Carson.
We are adjourned.
Thank you.